When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm so excited about this chapter and my guest, who really is the perfect person to help me cover this chapter. It is Kavita Mudon-Finn. Kavita has taught in a number of places, including MIT. She taught a class at Game of Thrones on MIT. She's got a book out about queens of the 15th century, so she's an expert on the War of the Roses. And she's written specifically on Game of Thrones and Cersei in particular. She's got a book coming out in 2022 called An Introduction to Global Medievalism in Popular Culture, which I am absolutely going to read as soon as it's out. Today we are covering the famous conversation between Ned and Cersei in the Godswood, where we hear the titular phrase Game of Thrones on Cersei's lips. Steve and I cover Unbowed, Unbent, Unbroken. Without further ado, here is Dr. Kavita Mudon-Finn. Kavita, I feel like this book gives us very, very little of Cersei's interior.
Very little.
And we will get POV chapters from her later in later books. Mm-hmm. But in this book, the latter half of this one little chapter is the closest we get to Cersei talking about her own intentions, what mm-hmm. motivates her. And of course, this is all filtered through Ned's point of view.
Yeah.
But it's a tiny little glimpse into who the person I think really is Ned's true nemesis in this book. But of course, Ned can't see much beyond his own limited field of vision. And so we don't learn a lot about Cersei. But we do learn a little bit about her in this chapter.
Yes. Yeah. Honestly, this scene was the scene that really made me interested in Cersei way back in 2002 when I first read this book. Because I had come to this book series through the Wars of the Roses. As soon as Cersei was introduced to the narrative, I immediately thought, oh, she's meant to be an analog. And I actually didn't think of Margaret of Anjou initially. I had thought of the other queen who came immediately after Margaret of Anjou, Elizabeth Woodville. And the particular reason why Elizabeth Woodville came to mind is because the way that Cersei's family is set up, House Lannister, and the mm-hmm. way that Robert Baratheon is set up at the very beginning of A Game of Thrones as the party king.
Right.
He's sort of this binge sure. drinker, alcoholic, yeah. womanizer, all of these things. He is clearly very much an analog for the English King Edward IV,
yeah.
who
yeah.
started off his reign as this 19-year-old wunderkind. He was mm-hmm. he was an incredible battle commander. He won battle after battle after battle, just absolute cut a swath through his enemies, took the throne aged 19, avenged the death of his father in battle, avenged the death of his brother in battle. Supposedly, according to several different chroniclers, he was incredibly handsome, very charismatic, was supposed to marry a French princess, but met Elizabeth Woodville on a street next to a road in Northamptonshire, reportedly just completely fell head over heels for her. And after a variety of in-between things, he did end up marrying her. And that led to a recommencement of the Wars of the Roses.
Interesting.
So initially, when I was first reading this book, I thought, oh, she's Elizabeth Woodville. But then we get to this, and of course, there's the incest reveal in Bran's chapter. And I'm continuing. It's like, okay, this woman's really awful. What is going on? And then there's the scene where Robert slaps her, and it's public. It's in the middle of the banquet after the Hand's tourney. He's not supposed to be doing that. And this scene kind of comes after that. And she still has, like, I think she still has the bruise, and she makes reference to it, and Ned makes reference to it.
Right.
And Cersei kind of pins him and confirms a lot of his prior suspicions that Robert is not the man that he remembers. Ned is already having all of these doubts about Robert, and he gives Cersei this chance that ends up being fatal to him,
right.
Not because he necessarily cares about her, but because he does not want any more children to die. I don't know that
That's
Ned necessarily cares very much about Cersei.
Absolutely. Okay, let's jump in the chapter. I'll read my synopsis of it.
Sure.
No, I'm glad we're already there. That's exactly where I wanted to go with this conversation. So here's my synopsis. Ned is discussing his broken leg with Pycelle. It seems that the bone is knitting, albeit painful. Pycelle shares the contents of Tywin's letter to Cersei. Lord Lannister is angry over Ned's decision to bring Gregor Clegane to justice. Ned imagines that the Archmaester is parroting Cersei to him. Baelish visits with news of Robert's hunt. The two discuss the Hound and his possible reaction to his brother's supposed fate. Ned's thoughts turn to the death of two Targaryen children after Robert's rebellion. Ned worries about what will happen to Cersei once Robert knows the truth. In an effort to save them, Ned arranges to meet Cersei in the fog, Godswood. The two talk over Robert's physical abuse. Then the conversation turns to her relationship with Jaime. Ned's suspicions are true. Cersei confirms that all of her children were fathered by her brother. Cersei attempts to bring Ned into the conspiracy, but Ned instructs her to leave town and leave Westeros with her family. Cersei tells him that if you play the Game of Thrones, you either win or you die. So, Kavita, would you like to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I climb the ladder of chaos?
You know, I have a bunch of characters and themes and stuff, but let's climb the ladder of chaos and see what happens.
All right. Excellent. You go first.
All right. So one thing that had struck me when I read the reread before that, when I was rereading it for teaching it, was that Ned is incredibly sleep deprived during this chapter.
Right.
Because I remember also when the first season of Game of Thrones aired on HBO, there was a lot of talk about how stupid Ned was, how foolishly he behaved. This guy should have known better. He trusted too easily. Cersei just walked right over him.
You think he just needs better sleep?
I'm that's part of the problem, I think.
spoken by a mother who knows from pain.
Yeah, like sleep deprivation is real. And if you're not getting proper sleep, your decision-making suffers. I pointed this out to my students and they rolled their eyes at me.
Ned is actually a genius. If only he could get 8 hours of rest, he would just be thinking circles around everyone.
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far. He did. I mean, one of the things that happens in this chapter is he finally solves the murder of Jon Arryn. What sort of, he thinks he solved the murder of Jon Arryn.
Uh-huh.
It turns out he did not, in fact, solve it at all.
No.
But he thinks he solved the murder of Jon Arryn. He at least finds out potentially why Jon Arryn went down. This does not actually solve any of his problems. In fact, it creates a whole series of new problems for him.
Yeah.
But the fact is also, on top of all of these other problems that he has been having, he is also not just sleep deprived, but on opiates.
Oh, you're man, so right about this.
Yeah,
you're
he's so on right. like the Westerosi version of morphine. His decisions seem
so
questionable.
Right.
I feel like we need to remember this.
All right, now wait. Okay, that is the case. In this chapter, he decides, instead of taking more milk of the poppy, he's just going to get drunk instead. So he's probably got some opiates in his system.
Oh, he probably does.
Plus he's got honey wine in the system. Plus he doesn't have enough sleep.
Mm-hmm. And I bet he's not eating properly either.
Oh gosh, that's great.
This man is not, he is not in a good mental state. He is not in a good physical state.
Uh-huh.
But also, I mean, at the end of the day, Ned Ned Stark is a man who wants to believe the best of people, and he wants to do the right thing in a way that preserves as many lives as possible.
Yeah.
So when he's faced with this absolutely catastrophic revelation that the king's heirs are not his children, that his wife has been betraying him for their entire marriage, and that the and more importantly, from a political standpoint, that the succession is now deeply in question, he needs to figure out what to do. And his first instinct is not, I need to tell Robert so he can fix it, so he can bring justice to this situation, because Ned knows what Robert's justice looks like, and Robert's justice looks like dead kids.
Yeah.
And so his immediate, like, so, I mean, I actually admire the instinct that he has, which is, I don't want any more dead kids. Like, I am done with dead children. What I want is to save as many people as possible. And that's unfortunately, in doing that, he seals his own doom.
Right. I think, all right, so what was interesting to me about this read that I had never noticed before is after Littlefinger leaves, he's sort of, he curses, and he's really lamenting that he has no one in the city he can trust. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of running through the Rolodex in his mind. He's thinking, like, eh, Varys, no, can't trust Varys. Pycelle, no, he's probably in the Lannisters' pockets. I could ask Selmy, and this is what caught my attention. He's like, I could ask Barristan Selmy, but he's old and rigid and will just tell me to do my duty. And the way that I read that was, Selmy's basically going to say, well, go tell Robert. That's your duty as Hand of the King. Tell Robert.
Yep.
And Ned decides he doesn't want that advice, right? He can already sort of imagine that advice. So he decides to take an alternative path. Instead of, like, laying the truth at Robert's feet, which he does intend to do eventually, he decides he's going to try to do this little intrigue back channel to try to get Cersei out of the country and save her children. So he is actually trying to play the Game of Thrones.
He is.
And he's doing it specifically because he thinks that the straight, you know, most honorable way forward may actually bring bloodshed. And I think sometimes this is overlooked about Ned. I think he actually decided to do something that's a little bit not above board or not direct or maybe a less honorable path.
Yeah. He has already seen how it goes if you try to take kind of the straightforward path, which is what happened when he was a kid and Robert came to the throne in the first place. It's that image that he keeps coming back to of these two little children who were just horrifically murdered. And these images keep haunting him. And there's also the image that is not haunting him, but we know it's there on reread, which is, of course, Jon Snow.
Interesting.
If you read this with the knowledge that Ned's biggest secret, which is the one that he takes with him to his grave, involves saving his sister's Lyanna's son, that makes it all the more tragic. Because Ned has been keeping this secret for 15 years at this point. That Lyanna had a son, that son is Jon Snow. And he knows that if he lets any of that on to Robert, Robert's going to kill Jon Snow.
Right.
Because he cannot stand the thought of any Targaryen being alive. And Robert's pride is not going to allow him to have these three children who Cersei claimed were his, but they're not. His pride's not going to let him keep those children around. And Ned knows that if Robert is capable of accepting the deaths of the two Targaryen children, and if he is capable of ordering the death of Daenerys, who is also a child, because it's worth remembering, Robert has already done that. He's already ordered them to send an assassin after Daenerys, who's 13. So Ned knows that Robert is absolutely 100% capable of killing children.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad you brought up Jon Snow, because it was odd to me how often I was thinking about Catelyn in this chapter. You know, Ned does think about her in the chapter. And I'm just going to read this one little section. So he's talking with Cersei, and he asks about Bran. He says, "My son Bran?" To her credit, Cersei did not look away. "He saw us. You love your children, do you not? Robert had asked him the very same question the morning of the melee. He gave her the same answer with all my heart. No less do I love mine. Ned thought, if it came to that, the life of some child I did not know against Rob, Sansa, and Arya, and Bran, and Rickon, what would I do? Even more so, what would Catelyn do? If it were Jon's life against the children of her body? He did not know. He prayed that he never would.
Yeah. It's
that little passage to me, I was thinking, Ned's been carrying this kind of worry. And he's trying to empathize with Cersei's predicament. He's thinking, well, actually, she's doing this to protect her children. Of course, I might do something similar. And of course, I think Kat would do something similar. And then his mind turns to Jon Snow.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, so try this on for size, is Martin foreshadowing with this passage maybe sort of a Lady Stoneheart versus John showdown?
I don't think so. I feel like it would be interesting thematically, but I don't know that it's geographically likely. I feel that Lady Stoneheart's arc is going to begin and end in the Riverlands. I don't think Kat is going back north. Even if John comes south, I don't think it's going to be till after that storyline has resolved. I feel like Lady Stoneheart is going to get that her storyline is going to come to an end, however that end happens. I feel like that's going to happen relatively early on in The Winds of Winter.
Sure.
And that by the time John gets to the Trident, she won't be there anymore. At least that's my kind of finger in the wind. It would be interesting.
Yeah.
To imagine. But one of the other things that's interesting about A Game of Thrones is that I do not believe that Martin had decided to go the Lady Stoneheart way when he was writing A Game of Thrones, because the original outline of the book actually had Catelyn going back north. So yeah, I remember when I was teaching, one of the things that we looked at was Martin's original pitch letter from 1993. And the pitch letter is like, it's one of those weird things, like people love to look at it and kind of try and see if they can figure out where the eventual end game is going to be. But some of the stuff in there is just strange. Like, I think John and Arya ended up together, which is weird.
Yeah. I remember that part of it.
And like Kat and Bran go up to the wall together. And I think Kat gets killed by the others, or like, I don't remember, but there was a lot of very odd stuff in there. But which is all to say that I don't necessarily think that Martin put this in here with the intention of foreshadowing anything going on with Lady Stoneheart, because I don't think Lady Stoneheart had been, was part of the narrative yet at this point.
It's interesting to me the kinds of things that are refrains in this first book.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this constant refrain about, you know, Benjen's missing. Eventually, you're going to have to pay off this question. You're going to answer it.
We're going to have to find out what happened to him. Yeah.
Yeah. What happened
I hope
to Benjen? The other thing that is refrained over and over again, at least in Ned's mind, but also from Catelyn's point of view, is this deep enmity between Lady Catelyn and John. And we don't find out till much, much later, you know, how wrong she is. But it is sort of this thing that Cersei brings up in this chapter. Like, hey, don't talk to me about honor. You're the one with a bastard. And so it's repeatedly brought up over and over and over that Jon Snow is a bastard. And of course, we think that George is going to pay that off by saying, actually, he's not. But I do wonder if there's going to be some reckoning with Catelyn. Anyway, just kind of things I think about.
One of the frustrating things, especially rereading these books, I read it and I just think, Ned, you should have just told her. I know I can see it makes sense why he didn't, but he should have. Especially it should, like, maybe not at first. I can understand why he wasn't sure. He didn't know her very well. But as they got closer, I feel like maybe 5 years in, he could have been like, so, by the way, just so you know, he's not actually my son. He's actually my nephew, but really we can't talk about it. We have to pretend he's my son, but you don't have to hate him because he's not actually my son. Like, I feel like there was a way he could have done that, but he didn't.
Right. Yeah, it's one of those things. It's like Catelyn to me, especially Book Catelyn, she's such a politically minded person, specifically with regard to the South. Right. I think that her mind is on Southern politics.
Yeah. And I think she would have understood if he'd explained it to her. Like, if
I was going to go a different direction, I would have been like, she's a doer. Like, she might act on that knowledge. You know, if she thinks, you know, something is to be done in the South, she might leverage John's true identity. I don't know. I mean,
she might. That might have been why. That could well have been why Ned decided not to tell her, because he didn't want to put her in a position where she found herself in a situation where she might be tempted to leverage that information. Maybe it is because he knows her so well. Because, I mean, if you look at someone like, for instance, Tyrion, and I think Catelyn shares a certain number of these characteristics. But if you look at someone like Tyrion, if you give him information, it doesn't matter why. And it doesn't matter if when you gave him the information, he cared or not, he's going to file it away. And later on, if he finds a use for it, it's not going to occur to him not to use it.
Right.
Like, information is knowledge is power. Tyrion very much operates on the knowledge is power model. And I think Catelyn operates that way as well.
I guess the other part of it is that, now I'm a student of ancient history, but you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there's this longstanding idea that a lord does not take advice from his wife. And things go badly. You start taking political counsel from your wife, things are going to go wrong.
Yeah. Well, actually, yes and no. There are a couple of very specific exceptions to that. There's this idea of intercession. So typically, yes, the general consensus was that men are not supposed to be taking advice from their wives. Wives are supposed to be in the domestic sphere, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the few exceptions to that was if you were a king, and you found yourself in a situation where, say, a city had rebelled against you, and you had come down with fire and brimstone and all of that stuff, and you said, okay, I am going to punish everyone in this city. But then a couple of hours later, the king has had time to cool down and realizes, oh, wait, maybe I don't need to burn an entire city to the ground, but I also don't want to look weak and look like I'm constantly changing my mind. That is where you bring in the queen. The queen is able to come in, make a big show of kneeling down in front of the king and saying, please spare these people, give them mercy. They haven't done anything wrong. And that the ceremony allows for the king to change his mind without looking like he's changing his mind. He's just being a really nice husband and listening to his wife.
So you're saying that Daenerys really needs a good queen. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yes, that's precisely what I'm saying.
Oh, goodness. I wanted to ask you about, the way this chapter begins, it's sort of Ned receiving some semblance of healthcare.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, here's something I just absolutely have no idea about. We give the idea that in the medieval period that doctors have like a few bag of tricks that they can use, but I'm wondering.
So my husband did his undergrad in microbiology, and he took a class called the History of American Medicine. And one thing that his professor apparently told him relatively early on was prior to the 20th century, you had just as likely a chance of being killed by a doctor as being cured by one.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, there's actually a lot written about this in the ancient world, like, you know, the doctors were thought of as torturers because that's just commonly how, because they were trying out different things, and you know,
I mean, they just sort of go with whatever worked, and sure. quite frankly, whatever worked might have been just as much luck as right. anything else.
So here's my question: would someone like Ned Stark receive better treatment than someone who, you know, commoner living in a local village?
Oh, that's
Or would like the doctors be like, they kind of suck across the board?
I would say the latter, because the someone who is living kind of outside of a city, there are certain types of like there's just certain problems they wouldn't have. Like you would not be dealing with the same level of like drinking what like unclean sure. drinking water, close living conditions, the spread of disease. You would not be dealing with a lot of the same issues. And also there is a long and very complicated history of folk medicine. And in so many cases, folk medicine was often more effective than whatever it was that the official doctors were doing. And depending on what you were looking for, especially for stuff like midwives and childbirth, and what were generally regarded as women's ailments, those were almost exclusively dealt with through unofficial channels. Unless you were getting up into the really, really, really high social statuses when women were actually being treated by official doctors, in as much as that was good or bad. If you're going out into the country, and even if you were sort of kind of mid-grade nobility, if you were out on your estates in the country and you weren't in the city, you would get treated by a midwife.
Interesting. So, I mean, Pycelle's answer to Ned's situation is like, hey, man, the pain's probably good. So that's good. Glad I'm checking in on you. You're in pain. That sounds good. Now here's some opium, and you know, call me in a week. I mean, it's not much.
No, it's not. And I do believe, though, that in this particular case, this is not a doctor who's actually being very helpful. And I think part of Pycelle's goal at this point is actually to keep Ned unconscious. Because if Ned is unconscious, there's a lot of other stuff that could happen around him that could sort of continue to push him into an unfortunate position.
Yeah, we see the same thing kind of happen with Tyrion after Blackwater, right?
Yeah, that's exactly. Like, it's one of the things that happens if what you want is to keep someone out of the picture and they are already injured. Uh-huh. I mean, really, all you have to do is just keep feeding them opiates, and they're not going anywhere.
And I think Ned sees through some of that.
Yes, yes, he does.
So give Ned credit at least for that point.
As I said earlier, like I am of the opinion that he deserves significantly more credit than he gets. I don't think he's a mastermind necessarily, but I don't think that he's the sort of great lumbering bull in a china shop that a lot of people seem to think he is.
Yeah, I agree with you on this one. I argue this a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm always kind of saying, like, how would, you know, we have the benefit of hindsight. And of course, Ned, things didn't turn out well with Ned. So we can sort of be geniuses because we can look at Ned's narrative in retrospect.
Yeah.
But every now and again, I kind of lapse and I say, this idiot.
Yeah, every now and again, it's like, oh, no, dude, you shouldn't have done that. No, what he ought to have done is gotten his kids out ASAP.
Yes, absolutely.
Shouldn't have even waited. He should have just been like, okay, we're packing you up. You're going home.
Right.
And once you are out of the city, then I will deal with all of this.
Uh-huh. Are you surprised at, I mean, you first read this in what, 2002, right?
So it's 2002, hard, yep.
It's probably undergrad. Hard to remember what surprised you and what didn't. Mm-hmm. But are you surprised that Cersei was so forthright?
Yes.
I mean, she does not flinch. She's got no sense of shame. She even hints that she was responsible for Bran's fall in this chapter.
Yes, she does not explicitly admit to it, but yeah, she's like, he saw us. She gives a reason for why he fell without specifically saying, yep, I was the one who did it, or Jaime was the one who did it. Like, I think Ned is able to read between the lines and go, okay, well, obviously Jaime was the one who did it.
Yeah.
Because he knows what Jaime is capable of. But yeah, I mean, I found it very interesting. And I do remember being surprised when I first read it. And this was really what kind of made me particularly interested in Cersei on my first read was, Oh, I did not expect her to react this way. Now, going back to it on reread, particularly having read a lot of the supplementary stuff, the history, the world books, that kind of thing, Cersei's attitude, while I 100% do not condone it, I can see where she gets it from. Because if you look at Cersei's childhood, she grew up, first of all, like she was in Casterly Rock until her mother died. Her mother and her father were first cousins. And when she came to court, it was the Targaryens who were still in charge.
Right,
and the king was married to his sister. So she would have been seeing
a that. Royal ideal, right?
She would have been seeing like that would have been her first impression of what royalty looks like, what a king and a queen look like.
That's right.
And if what she's seeing there are two people who are very obviously related to each other, who are very obviously siblings, and she's already got this kind of weird codependent relationship with Jaime, which we know that she already has because she describes it as having been there ever since they were born. It's like she says, since we were children together, and why not? The Targaryens wed brother to sister for 300 years to keep the bloodlines pure. And Jaime and I are more than brother and sister. We are one person in two bodies. We shared a womb together. He came into this world holding my foot, our old Meister said. So she's already got this incredibly twisted codependent relationship with her brother. And if you add to it this kind of very early idea, this would have been something that was an impression that was made on her when she was like 8, 9, 10 years old. It's not clear what I don't remember exactly when it was that Tywin brought her to court, but she was still relatively young when it happened.
Well, even, and this is admittedly, this is my headcanon talking here, but let's imagine that she has an education along the same lines that Sansa does, where she has this woman of the faith teaching her Targaryen history.
Yeah.
You know, so if she's learning Targaryen history from a person, you know, that represents, you know, the faith of the seven, and she's learning about these great heroic figures,
Jaehaerys and Alysanne.
That's right. And idealizing that whole history, you know, you can kind of see that sense of morality forming.
Yeah.
Or maybe not morality as much as normalcy.
Yeah, so social acceptance. It was socially acceptable, at least within very specific parameters.
Right.
And if you add to that this kind of this relationship that she's already got with Jaime, and you add to that the fact that the Lannisters very much consider themselves to be like apart from the rest of Westeros, very much the same way that the Targaryens do. It's not a surprise that, like, when you think about it and with all of that context, I think her attitude becomes a lot less surprising.
Let me read this last paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
The queen stood, and what about my wrath, Lord Stark? She asked softly. Her eyes searched his face. You should have taken the realm for yourself. It was there for the taking. Jaime told me how you found him on the Iron Throne the day that King's Landing fell, and you made him yield it up. That was your moment. All you needed to do was climb those steps and sit. Such a sad mistake. I've made more mistakes than you can possibly imagine, Ned said, but that was not one of them. Oh, but it was, my lord, Cersei insisted. When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. There is no middle ground. I have a question about this. And, you know, we've heard that story before about, you know, Ned finding Jaime sitting on the throne. Actually, I have two questions about this. The first is that, you know, Cersei is criticizing Ned and saying this was such a bad mistake. It was yours. It was yours for the taking. You could have taken the realm. But isn't she also criticizing Jaime in this moment as well?
I mean, yes.
I mean, we were just talking about how the fact that she has this ideal of what royalty looks like. And she sort of patterned her own life after these Targaryens. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't she think that this is her moment as well? That Jaime botched this moment?
Yes. Yeah. And some, she was not physically there. She was all the way in Casterly Rock when this happened. But yeah, I'm sure that that there was some part of Cersei who's like, oh, Jaime, you could have taken the throne yourself. And then you could have, then I could have been your queen. And it would have been exactly like, what's interesting is that we find out in A Feast for Crows that Tywin had planned for Cersei to marry Rhaegar Targaryen, the last Targaryen prince. And this was, of course, assuming that Rhaegar's wife, Aelya Martell, died in childbirth, which Tywin had expected her to do. But he had also kept as a backup, if that marriage didn't work out, Rhaegar's younger brother, Viserys, who we do meet in A Game of Thrones. So Tywin had this idea that Cersei was going to marry into the royal family one way or the other. Did anyone actually expect Jaime to take the throne? I don't think so. Huh. I don't know that even Cersei would have necessarily expected that, because Jaime by that point was a member of the Kingsguard. So I don't necessarily know that... I'm not sure. It's really hard to say, because Cersei, when this was happening, Cersei would have been 15 years old.
And that means that Jaime was about 15.
Yeah, Jaime and Cersei were both 15 at the time of Robert's Rebellion. And so 16, I think, would be the oldest that that Jaime would have been at the end of Robert's Rebellion when he kills Aerys and becomes the Kingslayer. Mm-hmm. We don't actually know what Cersei thought about Jaime killing Aerys. We never actually get that in her thoughts. We do not get much about Aerys at all, which is interesting, given that he would have been a really important figure in Cersei's early life, because she was at court with her father. Her father was Hand of the King. And there is also one little snippet that we get from Jaime's POV. Cersei was instrumental in getting him named to the Kingsguard, which implies that she talked to the king and convinced the king to do it, or that she was in some way involved in that that decision-making process. It's not clear to me how, it's not clear to me what she did or what she didn't do, but that is interesting, I think, in its own way.
Yeah, it is interesting. When she says, you know, we are very much the same person, we have two bodies, but we're the same person.
Yeah.
I kind of get the sense that when she says that, she's like, Jaime is sort of an extension of my body. Like, I'm the brains of this operation. And every now and again, I need him to act on my behalf. But I do get that sense that she views Jaime in that way.
Yes, she absolutely views Jaime as an extension of herself. She also views her children as extensions of herself.
Yeah, right.
She says that she loves them. And I think that she believes that, but her concept of sort of maternal love is smothering. She very much sees her children as extensions of herself. She expects them to do exactly what she wants them to do. That's partly why it's so disturbing to her when Joffrey starts to kind of move out of her control. And when he starts to behave in ways that she doesn't necessarily want him to behave. I think that that's partly why she starts to feel nervous about him, she's not really sure what to do. It's not necessarily that she disapproves of what he's doing. It's that he's doing it without consulting her.
Right. She's lost control.
Yeah. She's lost control of him, I think, is the bigger problem. It's not so much that Joffrey is doing things that she disagrees with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So notable introductions in this chapter. We hear about the Wind Witch, which is the ship that's supposed to take away Arya and Sansa.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the first time we hear this phrase, a roach in the rushes. Littlefinger says it, and I think that's sort of an analog to sort of a fly on the wall.
Yeah, fly on the wall, yep.
And I love that little turn of phrase. I thought, oh, that's a nice little detail there.
Yeah.
No notable departures. Differences. I think that there's a few things you could call about out about Ned's conversation with Littlefinger, but the difference between the show and the books that most interested me was Cersei talking about her abortion.
Yes.
Because it comes up in the show in a much different way.
It does.
She's talking with Kat in the show. Yeah. She's talking with Kat. This is early on. This might have been like,
it's like the second or third episode. Yeah.
Yeah. And she basically says, hey, you know what? I had a stillborn son once, and I was I was brokenhearted. And you know, Kat was like, I never heard of this. And that's not in the books at all. But it did make me think of that conversation with Catelyn. Here, maybe Cersei is talking about this, but putting a spin on it in order to sort of ingratiate herself with Kat.
That would not surprise me if that was sort of the implication. But also, the other thing that the show added later on was that one brief scene between Cersei and Robert. I don't remember what episode it was in, but it was like somewhere mid-season, like episode 5 or 6 or something like that. It was before everything went down. There was this scene between Cersei and Robert.
I know which scene you're talking about. It's such a great scene. It's really the only scene where Robert and Cersei actually like
interact,
laugh together, right?
Yeah.
We haven't had a real fight in 9 years. Backstabbing doesn't prepare you for a fight, and that's all the realm is now. Backstabbing and scheming and arse-licking and money-grubbing. Sometimes I don't know what holds it together.
Our marriage.
So here we sit, 17 years later, holding it all together. Don't you get tired?
Every day.
How long can hate hold a thing together?
Well, 17 years is quite a long time.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
And you get this brief glimpse of the kind of relationship that they might have had if the two of them had actually been able to communicate with each other.
Right.
But they it never works out. And we don't get that in the book at all. In fact, in the book, one of the things that that we get is repeated confirmation that their marriage was, in fact, abusive.
Right. Sure.
Like, I could not picture the Robert and Cersei of the book having that conversation. Like, I don't think I could picture that, because he is so much more violent towards her in the book.
Well, yes, he absolutely is more violent. And she's throwing like goblets at him and like chipping his teeth and whatnot. But there is this sense in which Robert is in the books is completely baffled by her. He like he has no idea how to relate to her.
Cersei is a very rare thing in Robert's world, a woman who does not want him. And the irony is that the other woman who did not want Robert was Lyanna.
Interesting.
And of course, Robert does not know that. Robert does not, like, Ned has tried to tell Robert that, and Robert does not believe him.
Interesting.
But that's the thing. It's like this weird parallel, the one extant parallel between Cersei Lannister and Lyanna Stark.
The woman he most loves and the women he most hates, right?
Yep. Neither of them want him. And like all that, because Robert has kind of built his life around being the sex, drugs, and rock and roll guy. Like he loves to drink, he loves to eat, he loves to fight, and he loves to sleep with women. And I there is an obvious additional word, but I don't know how explicit you're allowed to be on this podcast, so I will leave that out. He loves to do all of those things. And as far as we can tell, with the exception of Cersei, Robert is not one of those guys who gets off on non-consensual sex, which unfortunately is prevalent in these books. But instead, he just wants to have a good time. But that is not something that Cersei is ever going to give him. And we do not get this in A Game of Thrones. We do not get this until A Feast for Crows, when we actually get Cersei's POV. But Cersei does actually talk about how her marriage to Robert was abusive, like he was physically abusive toward her. Yes, she did fight back. But when you think about how Robert is described as like 7 feet tall, huge, built like a football player.
Right.
You can just imagine like, that would not have been like, even if she is fighting back, what's that going to get her?
Yeah. Interesting.
So I think in this scene, you get little glimpses of, okay, maybe like Cersei Lannister's awful. I don't think it's going to change anybody's opinion on whether Cersei Lannister is an awful person. But I think what we get in this scene is nuance. We get
nuance, and even Ned is trying to see the world from her perspective, right? Which sort of invites us as the reader to do that.
Because, I mean, Ned has already been on this journey. Like, from the second he sees Robert in Winterfell, Ned is forced into this position where he's acknowledging that his best friend is not the man he remembers. Uh-huh. And this is kind of the nail in the coffin for that, because he realizes not only is Robert capable of killing 13-year-old Daenerys, he is also apparently very, very capable of beating his wife. And this is not something that Ned approves of, clearly. Right. Like, this is not the way that Ned lives his life, and this is not who Ned wants his best friend to be.
Well, more than anything, and I think that this actually does round us out a little bit here to this mm-hmm. chapter, is that more than anything, we have been told in no uncertain terms several times in this book that Ned has a red line that he won't cross.
Yeah.
And the red line is bringing children into the violence of politics.
Yes.
That is so distasteful to him that he's willing to walk away from his oldest and best friend in order to put up that kind of stance. And so this meeting with Cersei is absolutely well earned. This is absolutely mm-hmm. in keeping with Ned's character.
Yes.
He will not cross that line, even to the point that, you know, even if it's sort of this back channel intrigue, which is a little bit distasteful to him. It's mm-hmm. so much better than the alternative. And of course, we know this is what gets Ned killed.
I know. And it's awful. He is absolutely doing the right thing here. He is. Like, I think, and that was one of the things that frustrated me when the show was airing and people were going on about how stupid Ned is. I was like, no, he's not stupid. He's just a good guy who is dealing with awful people.
Uh-huh.
To be fair, like, Ned made mistakes. He should have had more. He should have come with an army. He should not have shown up with like 40 men. Like, that was a mistake. He did not like that. There are a lot of things he could have done better. And a number of them, we actually see Tyrion doing better in A Clash of Kings.
Right.
But even Tyrion isn't able to hold on to this position. Like, that is how, that is how dangerous it is to be Hand of the King.
Uh-huh. Well, I do want to call out, we probably need to wrap up here, but let me just call this out and get your impression on this.
Mm-hmm.
Ned walks into that Godswood, or limps into that Godswood, thinking that he's armed with the truth, right? So he's come prepared to have a truth fight.
Yes.
And what he is not expecting is for Cersei also to come armed with the truth.
That's right.
And to give as good as she gets, look him right in the eye, speak truthfully, and just not flinch, because she views the truth with a different interpretation. And Ned has not even imagined, it's not even occurred to him that Cersei might do that. Confess, but have a good reason for everything mm-hmm. that she's done.
Yeah.
That's something that it just hasn't crossed his mind at all.
Yeah, like, it's not a good reason.
Yeah, he thinks it's his armor. It ends up really, really coming back to bite him.
Yeah, it is really difficult, because, like, you're right. He does not, he expects Cersei to lie. He expects Cersei to do what a Lannister would do.
Or cower, it's true, now I have to flee. I mean, that's not her. That is absolutely not in her character to do that.
It is not. No, not a chance. Like, I, I am sure, like, he might have, yeah, I think he might have expected her to try and defend herself, to try and, to try and pretend that it didn't happen, to claim that these are Robert's kids. Like, I'm sure he expected all kinds of things, like to threaten him or any, you know, like my dad will find out about you or whatever. But instead, she's just like, no, it's true. Like, she accepts it. And not only does she accept it, she ends up confirming a lot of his worst fears about Robert. And I think that's part of his, that's part of what really throws him for a loop in this scene. It's not just that, that Cersei is telling him the truth. It's that her truth is confirming what he had already feared.
Yeah.
And that she, and he's starting to see her as a human being, which I think is also a little worrying to him, because he was, it would be much easier if he could just look at her the way Robert does and think, oh, she's awful. She's frigid. She's whatever. It would be much easier for him to deal with this if he could be dispassionate, but he can't.
Right. Right.
And he pities her.
He does. He should be pitying himself.
I mean, I think he can pity her too. I feel like that's one of the strengths of Ned's character is that he can pity.
Well, he at one point he actually says, "I don't know which one of you I pity more."
Right? Yeah.
And you know, she's like, "Keep your pity. That's not what's going to happen in this conversation." By the way,
it's not. No.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now Steve and I talk about Unbowed, Unbent, Unbroken. Jor finds out his father is dead. Jimmy and Bronn get into trouble in Dorne. Arya's learning to lie better. And yes, this is the episode with Sansa's wedding night. Here's comic Steve Osborne. Steve, what would be a video that... The video is more memorable than the song.
Maybe David Lee Roth, Just a Gigolo.
I mean, David Lee Roth in anything. He's just such a goofy looking guy.
Yeah. I mean, when it was it Panama one where he's like riding the big inflatable microphone?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we're talking high kicks.
Flamboyantly heterosexual.
Yeah, it's David Lee Roth. Flamboyantly heterosexual. I like that. Yeah. Yeah.
He was one of those guys where you're like, when you're listening to his voice, you think that this guy's got to be a character.
Right.
And then you see him in person and you're like, oh my God, I had no idea. This guy's more than a character. He's flamboyantly heterosexual.
Yeah, he actually is like a character. Like he looks like if you went to the opening of like a strip mall and they had the caricature artist there. And you say, draw me as a rock star. And then that image got off the page.
And just too much.
Yeah, it's like, man, why is the smile so big and the eyes so wide? No one kicks like that.
Leather chaps and a leopard vest? Oof. That's just too much.
Just, and then his little, like, he does his little, like, shoulder things where he would, like, not even a shimmy, but it was like it's as if he was leading a marching band and he put the thumbs up near his chest and just sort of worked his shoulders out. And it was just something so sexual about it without he being even a little bit arousing.
And yet he seems like he's having so much fun.
Yeah.
It's like I should be disturbed by this, but he's having so much fun.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, you got to figure he had to be like awful to work with.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, just a nightmare to work with. Like, he'd probably just come in and just so showy. And the songwriting is like, I should howl right here. Like, all right, you're going to do it anyway.
Now, let's say that this guy was like your sandwich artist. Would you put up with it?
Yeah, you know, you would because you just get, you know, it's... You're probably one of those things like, I don't know why you always go back when you know he's working. I mean, it's always going to be too much mayonnaise. Always.
He's spinning. He's slapping meat down while he does a full 360.
Yeah. Just shredded lettuce everywhere.
See, I think I would take it from my sandwich artist. I don't think I would take it from my barista. I'd be like, man, just make the coffee.
Yeah, because usually if you're going to get coffee... There's a, you know, it's like, I mean, as much as I love coffee, it's the percentage of times that I go to get coffee that are more recreational as opposed to a necessity are much lower.
Now, here's what I would like. Everything's cool, even keel, get the coffee. But as I'm taking the first sip, he goes into his little scat talk.
Boozy, boozy, bop, zitty, bop.
That's what I could get, because I've got the sip, you know.
Yeah, you give one sip and you kind of give him a nod like, oh, that's good. And he's like, I'm a lizzy billy, I'm a lizzy billy, bop. Like,
yeah, that would work.
All right.
I'd be like, man, I'm going to tip that guy because he did not have to give that to me.
Yeah. Or if every time he was grinding the beans, he did that. Like as soon as he goes and pushes the button, it's like, I'm a lizzy billy, bop. And then when he's done, zip, bop.
So it's accompanying the buzz.
Yeah.
The grinding noise also has the scat singing over it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's also acceptable.
Oh, man. Well, that, you know, that leads us into our episode, Steve. All right. Let me think. If you ever just decide to incorporate that into, I don't know if you have like a catchphrase that you've ever used. I'm going to suggest that instead of a catchphrase, if ever you're looking for one, you just kind of do his little scat singing after each joke.
That's their cue to laugh.
A little catchphrase that just kind of cues them into,
as
like,
opposed to the jump kick. just...
Well, I think that the jump kick is only for callbacks.
That's right. A roundhouse to let them know that that was something that was from before.
Sure. Yeah. Your foot is the arrow pointing them back to the previous joke. Steve, this episode was worth it just for the line, the dwarf lives until we find a cock merchant.
Yeah, exactly. That's an incredible... In fact, it might have been the only redeeming part of this episode.
I don't know about that. I like this. I liked several parts of this episode. But I think this is interesting because we've had situations before where I really didn't like an episode.
Yeah.
And you were like, yeah, it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you really didn't like this episode.
It felt very disjointed. I know the ending is particularly controversial. I did a little research.
The ending sucks. I don't even want to talk about the ending. The ending's...
Well, but here's
the ending angers me. But I think if you delete the ending, you got a pretty decent episode. But maybe I could be convinced otherwise.
I think it's okay. Yeah, because up until that part, I was just sort of like, I felt like I was just watching as opposed to being engaged in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, then it's really hard to then look back without the lens of the ending. Somehow coloring, you know, your everything else, right? But I think the ending is worth discussing because I find it fascinating to one degree because I thought about this a lot. We are used to...
Well, before we go there,
okay,
I do really want to come back to this line. I mean, I think that almost anything could... any statement could be enhanced by the qualifier... until we find a cock merchant.
Cock merchant, yeah.
Like if you're doing fortune cookies, for instance, you know,
instead of adding the in bed,
take advantage of the next business opportunity until we find a cock merchant.
Yeah, got it. I like that. Well, and that is an interesting, like, so that happens, right? So this becomes... I think that might have been one of my issues is that, I mean, again, I don't know how this compares to books, and this is Game of Thrones.
You've seen t-shirts, right? The t-shirts say, like, I drink and know things, like Tyrion's right. Got... So you've seen that.
Yeah, yeah.
I really think that there's a merchandising opportunity here for just the ... until we find a cock.
No, that's fair. Like, I mean, that's like, you know, or, you know, don't wake me till I've had my, or, you know, talk to me till I have my coffee, or until we find a cock merchant. Like, I think that's a good mug.
Or,
yeah.
Or just a mug that, like, when it gets hot, that's when the qualifying statement comes up.
Yeah, because now you've got your coffee.
Yeah.
So don't talk to me till I have my coffee, and then you fill coffee, and then it just hyper colors out. Yeah, which suggests a little coffee alone.
All right, let's talk about Sansa's wedding night. This is not going to be fun.
Well, so here's an interesting situation. We've got, like, we're so used to the big dramatic endings of these shows, and they mm-hmm. usually involve murder, like a dramatic death. And here we have something, and so that changes the course of many people's lives. And here we have something that, if you look at it just from...
It's either murder, or it's like some sort of magical reveal, or it's sure. Like someone's got a big army that they didn't have before.
But we've gotten used to this big ending. Like, always, like, usually it's episode 9, but there's the Joffrey, you know, happens. And then, you know, we have these little moments that where it's like, whoa, that's dramatic. And we had the whole thing with Barristan where we're like, meh. You know, and is that supposed to be the big ending? So then you look at this and say, well, this is one of those big endings. This, it's just not murder. It's not, you know, so I find that it's fascinating to me that, like, societally, and as fans, you can kill a main character in a gruesome fashion and you'll get 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. People will be upset. People will be, you know, somewhat polarized, but it won't necessarily have the same reflection into the critical response. In fact, it'll be considered bold, and Game of Thrones still got it. And so in this case, we have something that is completely jarring to a character that we have been tracking for a very long time.
Yeah, a character that we have developed a, an affection for, right?
Right. Ah, she's just in another bad spot again, and then it comes to fruition. Everything that we've been, like the tension that's been building, she's been avoiding this kind of a moment pretty much the entirety of this series.
And she's been dodging bullets for sure, right?
And then now it happens, and it's so gut-wrenchingly off-putting that the critical response was very, very negative. Now, again, I'm not saying, yay, this ending. I'm saying I find it interesting that we can watch, you know, Catelyn Stark get her throat opened up and people be like, yeah, wow, what a bold episode. Uh-huh. And part of it is, I think, because that's it, right? That's it for her. Her arc ends there.
I mean, there were people that didn't like that either, but here's the difference between those two things. I think this... what happens to Sansa is, which is, you know, brutal rape, that, by the way, I think that you see it through Theon's facial expression, right?
Right.
I think at that point it cuts to audio and you're just seeing Theon's reaction to it. And I think sometimes that will be worse than actually seeing someone's throat open up.
Right, right.
Because it's your own imagination. But in addition to that, I think that Sansa's experience hits too close to home for some people.
Sure.
Like, it's hard. It's actually hard to imagine someone cutting someone else's throat because it's something you've never really seen in real life before, never experienced anything remotely close to that.
And there's a gore aspect to it that does feel other, like fiction. Like,
it's a little, exactly. It's like I've seen this in a dozen horror movies. But what happens to Sansa just is going to hit way too close to home for a lot. So it doesn't feel like fantasy anymore. It feels like this is the kind of stuff that happens in the real world. And I don't want this in my fantasy narrative. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. And I think, and again, I'm not advocating for this. I think this ending is problematic. But the thing is, it's also like, this is an interesting corner that they've painted themselves. And my understanding is that this does, in the book, it doesn't happen to Sansa, but it does happen. There is this type of scene that from what I've read, that it's actually more graphic and Theon is involved.
Yeah, Theon is involved, and it's, you know, it's not Sansa, but it is one of Sansa's friends or something like that.
Yeah, so the experience is there, right? And you may not have the same, and again, I don't know how this character is built up, so you may not have the same affinity for him. So in terms of just, like, because there was a lot of criticism, too, from, I think, about the writers that this, again, I'm just reading, you know, sort of postmortems that, like, oh, here it is, their brutality against women. It's like, well, it sounds like this, you know, they've diverged from the text, but they've still kept true to some of it, right? And so this happens. This is a thing. It's almost impossible to have any kind of a sequence now that you've painted yourself in this Sansa with Ramsay corner where he doesn't do something horrible.
I mean, all right, let's get at it a different way. They didn't have to paint themselves into a corner. They really didn't have to. They could. I mean, the books kept Sansa south, and they really didn't create another character. That character doesn't exist in this show's story. So they made a choice. To do this with Sansa, and this is not the first time they did it. They make Dany's wedding night more violent than it was in the books.
Yeah,
they made Cersei's experience with Jaime more violent in the Sept. And so it's like they kind of have a track record for this, and it's a choice that I think is unfortunate. I think that we've seen so much other horrible stuff in this world, specifically from this character.
Well, and there's also the element of, if you're trying to make Ramsay unlikable, I think you're good.
Yeah, you don't. It's not
right. I mean, this goes to the Joffrey scene with the prostitutes, right? Like, we didn't, you know,
unnecessary. Like,
lest you forget that Joffrey's a monster. It's like, no, he's hideous.
Again, that was another thing that they added. They added the violence to the prostitutes.
So that's a good point. So, I mean, I guess it is ripe for criticism, you know, so I get that. But and that's not even about me defending the scene. I just think it's an interesting notion of what we allow and what we think is okay. And she's gone through so much. Do we really need, you know what I mean? Like, there's a sense of, like, who is this for? What character arc benefits from this, right? Because if you're going to tell me this is supposed to be something that's going to convert Theon, well, I'm not sure I want to sacrifice Sansa for Theon's journey.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? True. And you got to make this pay off. You know what I mean? And I don't think you can.
What do you think about using a whip as a weapon?
It seems like that should be your last resort, not your first option.
It's almost like these, like in Dorne, maybe they only have three weapons. A spear. They've got knives. The third daughter was like, well, what? I can't just do what you do. I need something else.
Yeah, they're just Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah, this whole thing, man. It's like these daughters
it's
come
like
in.
It's like the Hawkeye of these superhero daughters.
It's just too, that, I mean, it doesn't, these are not getting better, these scenes with them. I mean, wow, it is, it's almost as if the showrunners this season are like, we can get away with anything.
I'd like to be able to wield a whip. I don't know what I would
feel like
do
I would
with
hurt
that
myself.
Power.
I feel like I would hurt myself.
Oh, sure.
Time.
Sure. No, there's no question that
I've hit myself in the bridge of the nose with a yo-yo. What am I going to do with a whip?
I don't know why I think that that's kind of a cool idea. But then you see it on screen and it's like, no.
Yeah, well, because... Yeah.
A big sharp knife, that actually seems a lot more effective than a whip.
Well, a whip seems like she got in trouble, right? Like she, you know, give me your badge and your sword. You get this whip. That's what you get. Because, like, she, you know, she didn't follow police protocol or something.
I think you can be subtle with a whip.
It just seems like there's a lot of opportunity for that to not go the way you want. I see professional fishermen hook their pants.
First of all, you can't conceal it, so everyone knows that you got a whip. Yeah. And then you have to unfurl it and like do a little wind up with it.
Yeah, there's a whole, and it's so showy.
What was something about this episode that worked for you?
I like a hall of faces.
So you like a hall of faces.
Yeah, and it's interesting because this is a subplot that I think we talked about last time. Like, I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. One, because, you know, again, I'm decided to be all in on Arya, and it's weird, and it's a slow burn.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah, well, she's kind of become an acolyte, and she's supposed to live with this little, I don't know, life of servitude and silence most of the time.
Right.
So how are you going to make that exciting, right?
Right. And then I've been patient with some of those slow burns before, so I'm hoping to be rewarded in this.
I do kind of like seeing how the whole thing works, because now I can kind of see the Batcave. Like, oh, they bring people to this little temple who want euthanasia, and they embalm these bodies, and then they use some kind of magic to preserve the faces, and then they face it up.
Yeah, it's many faces.
I like to see them dig a little bit deeper and show me a little bit more beyond the magic. And I think maybe that's what the Red God is lacking. Like,
right.
Like, I don't know how any of this works. I don't know how any of the sort of the R'hllor fire god stuff magic works. But it almost seems like with the Faceless Men, they've got this little scientific method going on.
Yeah, and so, and that's fine. And again, I don't know if the and sometimes the explanation makes it muddier. But I'm just seeing, like, the more that onion, those layers start to unpeel, the better it is for me. So that's probably why I liked it, because I'm like, okay, I feel like we're getting somewhere. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where we're getting, but at least we're getting somewhere, because I don't want it to become sort of a throwaway plot, and I don't believe that it could be. I'm kind of enjoying the religious zealotry takeover that's kind of happening, and
it's really interesting that,
and I didn't think I was gonna like it, I'll be honest. I was kind of like, what are we doing? And then now I'm like, ooh, this is causing some serious complications.
Well, it also kind of shows you, okay, Cersei, now you have it the way you want it, right? Because at the end of this episode, Margaery's in jail, Tywin's not over her. She doesn't have to contend with the small council. She sent them basically packing. Her son is really easy to manipulate. And basically, Cersei is all powerful in King's Landing, or at least she thinks she is, right?
Well, and just like you had mentioned before, I think the last episode or whatever, which probably is a little bit foreboding.
Like, right.
There's like no momentum in Westeros.
Yeah. Things are going Cersei's way. So now you're waiting for the other shoe.
Exactly. Because it's like, oh, Tywin's getting everything he wants. Hey, I'll probably die while taking a dump.
I'll tell you something that worked for me. So we both were unhappy with the ending. We're not thrilled with Dorne. So I think that we've covered the things we didn't like.
Right. And you're actually convincing me now that we're having this conversation that there is more to like in this episode. I think it's just so colored by the ending. And
yeah, I think, it's hard not to let the ending. But here's something else that I really liked. I like the way that Jorah finds out that his dad's died.
Mm. Yeah, that was good.
I think that a lesser dialogue, lesser writer would sort of hit you over the head with it. Like, Jorah right. would say, what do you mean? My dad's dead? Or, you know, it would sort
yeah,
of...
Any, yeah.
It was done so subtly, and because you didn't have to, like, you know, hit it right on the nose, it allowed Jorah to kind of expressively play that scene with his face.
Yeah, and it totally... And in fact, it felt more authentic because there wasn't a lot of conversation.
Exactly. Exactly. Jorah's a character with a little bit more depth now. So I really like that. I like the way they did that.
I do appreciate as well that we're seeing the further unveiling of Littlefinger as somebody who's really got his hands in a lot.
Oh,
more.
He's playing everyone against each other.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, it is a wild, and I don't know if this is how he is in the book.
Yeah, that's right. He is this way in the book. And he's one of these characters that his superpower is he's always like two moves ahead of everyone else. And for whatever reason, his little plots and schemes seem to work out pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But having his finger in so many different pies is also really dangerous, right?
Right. Well, you also set up like now when you have no true allegiance, you have nothing but authentic enemies.
That's right. That's right. And all it takes is one of these people to be like, you know what? I don't believe any of this. And I'm calling bullshit. I mean, he comes from nothing and now he's in a position to become Warden of the North. And
Warden of the North.
Warden of the North.
Side note, I just watched Dark Knight Rises again. I don't know the last time you've seen that, but it was jarring to see Littlefinger in the opening scene.
Oh, is he in the opening scene?
Yeah, in fact, he's the guy that's trying to find out about Bane on the plane. And so there's this moment where he doesn't have the accent, but like I'm not looking at the screen for a second and I hear something like, is he on the plane? And I'm like, there's a little bit of that. And I'm like, what?
Well, I think that Bane stole everyone's accent in that movie.
That's right. Like it just, and
it's
then
like
now you
Bane's doing everyone's accent at once. He's got a little Michael Caine happening, but he's also got Littlefinger's accent.
There's a... And a very great sequence when Christian Bale's Batman, who learned no lessons from The Dark Knight, is grabbing Bane. Where's the trigger? Where's the trigger? Oh, man, she'll tell my mom.
You know what? If I ever have to watch that again, I'm absolutely going to use subtitles.
Yeah, there's a... It's people of Gotham.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to talk a little bit more about the two ways to create a knight, and I have further help here from Elio Garcia, who pointed me to the So Spake Martin archive at Westeros.org. This is Martin answering a question about knighting. So here's the question that was asked. Why did Lord Frey ask Robb to see about Olivar's knighting when he had more than enough anointed knights at his disposal to attend to the matter? Here is Martin's reply. Why should someone go to Harvard when they can get a degree from their local community college? There is great prestige in receiving your knighthood from a king, a prince, one of the king's guard, or other celebrated legendary knights. Getting knighted by a brother is like kissing your sister. We'll leave Jaime Lannister and the Targaryens out of that comparison. And getting dubbed by the local hedge knight is like graduating from Barber College. You get a sheepskin, maybe, but you don't try applying to law school. So in addition to some of what we uncovered last week, there's also prestige involved. To be knighted by a higher-ranked knight, or a more celebrated knight, or the king himself, has a lot more prestige that goes with it. Now, I will add this. I know people who went to Harvard. They're not any more special than anyone else. So let's just tone that down just a little bit, George. All right. And that is all for this week.